So, hello and welcome to our next installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. I've got a terrific topic today. We're going to be looking at, well, we've entitled it anyway, China Attacks. We've got a series of things we'll run through just in a moment. Mind that noise in the background there. So we'll run through an agenda, but firstly, I'd like to welcome our guests, or as always, our panelists. So we've got our Chief Strategist of the MB Fund and Nucleus Wealth, David Llewellyn-Smith. Ni hao, David.
Ni hao, Tim.
And our Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Ni hao, Damien.
Hi, Tim. Okay.
G'day, mate. Very good. Okay, so let's jump into an agenda. So we're going to first of all just run through some changes, or I guess some broad changes in Australian attitudes towards China, and then flip that around and have a look at some changes in Chinese attitudes towards Australia and also, I guess, the world economy. And then we'll deep dive as well into a couple of key areas of interest being coal, local visitors to Australia, and also real estate, Australian real estate as well. We'll then jump into some topics for looking forward and some projections and, I guess, some really just an idea of where we think this is all headed. And then, of course, wrap it all up with investments implications, as we do for how we run money every day for the MB Fund and Nucleus Wealth. So with no further ado, I'll hand over to one of you gentlemen, David, is it, to kick us off with our changes in Australian attitudes.
Thanks, Tim. So I wasn't sure whether to put changes in Chinese attitudes or Australian attitudes first in this presentation, because they, not that we're seeking blame here, but just to understand who's responding to what when, and therefore, you know, what the trajectory for the relationship is. I think you probably would put China first, but it's easier to describe if we start with Australia. So, as we're all probably aware, a few years ago we had a kind of internal affairs China panic in Australia, where it suddenly became obvious that there were Chinese influences in the parliament and the media that had not been fully exposed previously. Mm-hmm. A few books came out, The Silent Invasion being the most prominent by Clive Hamilton. And, you know, any number of different revelations, particularly around MPs who were, you know, in various forms being paid by what appeared to be agents of the Chinese Communist Party to do various things. The most prominent example was Sam Dastyari of the Labor Party. Mm. And, you know, he paid the price for that with his career. So I guess we could say 2 years ago that the Australia-China relationship, you know, was pretty much in its default position for what it had been for the last 20 years. And really even before that, where we were just friends and it was all about trade. But suddenly it became obvious that China was in the process of trying to influence Australian policy, in particular foreign policy, but also domestic, and doing so in a way that was really not open, but certainly a violation of sovereignty in any kind of broad sense. So, you know, that triggered
And can I sort of, I guess, add to that? I think Australia is probably at the forefront of the developed world in terms of the influence. I guess this is sort of almost a bit of a test case, probably Australia, New Zealand, possibly a little bit of Canada in terms of a bit of a test case in terms of
I think that's exactly
how far
right.
can be pushed.
Yep.
And I think probably a lot of the things that were happening were things that could very easily happen in non-developed countries without the batting of an eyelid, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And which I think is partly the idea as well. We've been doing this in African countries and Pacific countries and neighbours who don't have quite as strong sort of separation of powers and things like that. And that, yeah.
That's quite right. And nor were, you know, some of the emerging markets where China had operated previously so openly, you know, components in the US alliance network.
Yes.
And so, you know, the activities of the Chinese in Australia were very much a direct attack on ANZUS, the Australia-New Zealand strategic alliance, US strategic alliance. And so the Chinese were really kind of pushing the envelope in terms of, you know, the US hegemony, that's its power structure in the Pacific, when these activities started to come to light in Australia. And it was actually Trump administration that described Australia as the spearhead in this as well. So that's absolutely right. So the end result of this first kind of set of revelations was, of course, eventually some legislation to expose agents of foreign influence who were using money, basically, to win China influence. And, you know, that's basically, a pretty big shift by itself, a kind of anti-corruption move, I guess. But, you know, it was very much targeted at China, even though it was couched more generally. And that kind of kicked us off into what was a series of kind of dominoes that then rolled over and has just made the Australia-China relationship more and more fraught ever since. So we kind of graduated from that into, you know, a new kind of awareness and even alarm about what China was doing in the Pacific more widely, because it suddenly the new focus exposed that, you know, similar activities were underway right across the Pacific. China was doing its Belt and Road Initiative, you know, again, a lot of clandestine payments for this and that. There were deep water ports that were being mooted and built in various Pacific islands. They were very active in PNG, and there's some, you know, quite unsettling developments around PNG democracy. And all of it, kind of coincided as well with this rather large island grab that China has been doing in the South China Sea with the, you know, militarized islands claiming, you know, a lot of international waters for itself. So Australia, kind of following the Dastyari stuff and legislation, then took another step towards, I guess what we could say was what we're really saying here is we entered the US-China Cold War, such as it is, more or less on the US side.
And I guess to put that one in perspective, that's coming, I guess a lot of that comes from the Pence sort of speech last year, where he sort of laid out all the different areas of conflict between China and the US, and trade was just sort of one relatively small part of that. Like I guess part of the deal, taking that step back, was that China came into the World Trade Organization and there were all these sort of freedoms and things they were going to sort of open up to, and that progressed forward for a bit, but the last few years has been very little progression, and some would argue that they've sort of been going backwards on a number of sort of key measures there. And so, you know, that whole part of becoming, you know, the part of the world trade part is that companies and countries were outsourcing stuff to China that they wouldn't have considered outsourcing to what they would consider a foreign adversary.
Mm.
So there's things which they're getting made in China that they wouldn't have countenance getting that made in Russia or Iran or a country that was sort of seen as hostile to that country or that the country that that company was in. So China actually got itself into quite a unique position for a communist country, and, you know, that was with its own ambitions but you know, I think that was part of that was you'd probably blame Obama, I guess, in terms of being too light-handed. He's sort of there for a lot of that period,
I mean, Obama had a China containment strategy of sorts in his pivot to Asia, away from the Middle East.
Yeah,
but it was very it was much less comprehensive than what came under the Trump administration, and it kind of was more of a shift in strategic framework where, you know, the US was preparing a broad military encirclement that was going to try and contain China over the very long term. But, you know, he left China free to continue to develop through that position that you've described, relatively untouched.
Yeah, and the idea was that we help China develop and develop. China becomes more of a more democratic and more, you know, helps its people and,
yeah.
You know,
Do you feel that the, like, essentially, well, going back to say Dasjarian when all this sort of kicked off, it was a big awakening on essentially, well, I suppose it's stepping a little bit away from the Australian attitudes thing, but where there's a commercial aspect and then there's sort of like a government aspect that sort of, you know, that work in tandem, whereas then all of a sudden China comes along and, you know, through Chinese companies and big state and state-owned enterprises effectively is what everyone started to realise is, in effect, those two are intertwined when you're dealing with a Chinese company. So you've got Chinese companies, say, supporting, you know, political and commercial interests in Australia, and then all of a sudden they realise, hang on a second, this is effectively now becoming a state issue as opposed to just something that we can let along, you know, a liberal sort of trade policy, okay, we want, you know, inter-country trading, now it becomes actually a state problem.
Yes.
Mm.
I mean, I don't think it's entirely fair to characterise Chinese firms as all government agents. Like, that's not fair, but certainly SOEs.
Mm.
Even some SOEs have a bit of an arm's length to the government. That said, you know, they're obviously answerable to Beijing in the end. But I think that what you've just described there is now just absolutely crystallised in the relationship between all parties here. And that's more or less a shift away from the free trading regime that existed in the US hegemony to an inevitable response to the Chinese spearhead of bringing that state commercial tight-knit arrangement into that regime. And now those that used to manage it have no choice but to respond in kind. Because what was happening was China was eventually just going to dominate that system. And so if you want to preserve it, it did need a combined kind of response. That said, you know, the commercial and government relationship response from the West is still far less tight-knit than any response or any drive from the Chinese side.
And do you think that's a component of the fact that we are quite separate in the fact that commercial and you know, I guess, you know, this is the way the West has always operated, where government and commercial interests, one operates on one set of rule books and the other one operates on another, and now you're dealing with someone that has their own.
Well, the promise of China was always... Or the Chinese entry into the global trading system was always, you know, free, one economy, two systems. As it happens, you know, as it's turned out, that does not look compatible. Not the way China's currently operating, anyway. And that, we might discuss that later, is what the pivot was for China. I mean, it seems to have been basically the rise of Xi Jinping to a kind of imperial status. Has triggered a lot of this stuff. But I guess just going back to our chronology then, so we, Australia then, even before the Pence speech, you know, the sort of deep states of the US and Australia were on the move. The spooks suddenly became extraordinarily influential, having been marginalised for many years. They got the ear of everyone in power, and Australia pushed back quite hard in the Pacific under Turnbull. And there was, you know, some pretty meaty rhetoric on both sides through that. But basically, Australia started to beef up all of its aid to combat Chinese aid, plus, you know, was putting some pretty serious investment into some broadband and things like that. But also, you know, wherever the Chinese footprint looked like it was going to fall and create what were almost paramilitary presences in deep water ports or what have you, then the Australian presence would pile in on top of it. And that's still ongoing. You know, Australia, even yesterday, we're going to relaunch our old soft power TV network in the Pacific using, you know, the new Bogan network, which is an extraordinary waste of money. But, you know, this is only the thin end of the wedge, basically. This sort of sentiment and strategic outlook change in Australia also started to take shape in the Foreign Investment Review Board, and we started blocking major Chinese acquisitions. And what you were discussing before about the segue between Chinese firms and Chinese strategic goals in Beijing has now, you know, almost merged into one as far as FIRB is concerned. For instance, we had Hutchison, who's the guy that owns Hutchison, the Hong Kong billionaire,
Lee.
Yeah, he has very extensive infrastructure holdings in Australia already. He's always been, you know, a good corporate citizen and thoroughly welcomed as an investor. He made a play for Australian Pipeline Group, which was, you know, basically the gas monopoly on the East Coast, largely on the East Coast, some in the West. You know, 3 years ago, probably would have got through. And, you know, he's a guy who is not particularly well known for being close to the Chinese Communist Party. He's Hong Kong based, does have mainland interests, clearly would know the elite levels of the Communist Party, but not associated with them particularly, but he got blocked. So it's quite strong pushback now for FIRB and foreign acquisitions. You can probably see, you know, then in the background, we've got the Trump kind of trade war playing out, and that escalated, you know, a great deal with the Huawei arrest and stuff, and the whole kind of tech cold war, where you know, this is again where commercial interests start to operate in tandem with the state, especially Silicon Valley.
And there's been a pretty steady drip of news articles on various things, whether it's internet traffic diverted through China for unknown reasons, or you know, spy chips on things, and so that which seemed to be a government driven release of information to
yes.
That was it sort of amazes you with that, some of those stories where it was all sort of known 3 or 4 years ago, and I guess it, essentially a politician's gone, okay, what have you got for me for this week? I've got my barrow to push. Out they come.
So Huawei has intensified everything again. Australia has basically blocked Huawei from being involved in 5G, which is a big deal. One local operator has already pulled like a $1 billion deal that they were going to roll out Huawei equipment. And there's ongoing negotiations across the US Alliance Network over this. Britain and New Zealand are kind of toying with deals to let them in under certain conditions, but that's sort of still up for grabs. And then, you know, more recently, Australia responded with something that was really quite out of the box, and that was the exiling of Huang Zhimao, who was actually the guy behind some payments to Sam Dastyari, which is where we began this discussion. Plus, he had, you know, been a very prominent donor in the parliament. To both sides. He'd set up Bob Carr in a pro-China think tank. He'd been throwing a lot of money around. And he went for a trip to Hong Kong, I think, or maybe the mainland, I'm not sure which, and the spooks just put the foot down and wouldn't let him back wouldn't let him back in. He was a resident, but you know, is now essentially in exile. His application for citizenship rejected, and so you know, the Chinese media has been in foment over this as well, and so just in the last few weeks, you know, we've seen what I see as a bit of a tipping point in the Australian attitude to China, when we've seen, you know, a whole bunch of Australian former politicians, mostly, who are either working for or in some way in tandem with Chinese interests in Australia, suddenly resign from various prominent positions. So we've seen Bob Carr go from his think tank after years of defending you know, the China-Australia relationship with a to be kind, a glass half full kind of framework. John Brumby, you know, abandoned Huawei. Andrew Robb this week got out of Landmark, and you know, I think this is really telling us that the shift towards skepticism of China in this new Cold War sort of 2.0. Environment in which we find ourselves has made a step change for Australia. These are careerists who are getting out because they can see the writing on the wall, I think.
Or they've been told the writing's on the wall.
Or they've been told the writing's on the wall. Yeah.
Don't leave Australia, fellas. You might not come back in.
Either way, you know, it looks to me like, you know, the old adage in Australian foreign policy for the last 20 years has been, you know, the Yogi Berra saying, you know, when you come to a fork in the road, take it, on China and the US. We don't want to make a choice, and quite rightly, we shouldn't make a choice. But, you know, it's simply the case that Chinese interference in Australian sovereignty reached a point of critical mass such that, you know, the Australian strategic management, if you like, has kind of been forced to make something of a choice. It doesn't necessarily mean China, Australia has abandoned its relationship with China, but we've had to put up some boundaries and say, look, you can't go here or you can't go there. And at the moment, you know, it's really about what China will do in response and how far they'll try and push it to knock those boundaries down or go around them.
The other one, not on that list, and I haven't seen anything recently about it, but, you know, when Joe Hockey was treasurer, there was a bit of movement on the whole housing, foreign, you know, what are we going to do about foreigners buying Australian houses that are sort of basically just openly skirting the rules? And he had some forced sales and then and sort of a whole plan about what he was going to do, and then he was deposed and everything all went away and it all went quiet, and a big flow of more, you know, foreign money came in.
Yep.
I guess as a key sort of plank in the housing market, we've sort of spoken about China fleeing the Aussie market.
Yep.
But we haven't spoken about whether Australia's going to wait until the horse is gone, obviously, but then close the door so they don't come back in, or what's, I don't know, have you heard anything on that?
I haven't. I mean, the ATO was asked to police those new laws from Hockey.
Yep.
And they appeared to be determined to do it until he disappeared.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the free trading Turnbull, I think, just rang the ATO commissioner and said, just pretend. That would be my guess.
Yeah.
And so, as you say, the money ran amok again. I guess we'll come back to this. I don't think it's going to matter either way, because I don't think the Chinese money's coming back. But,
no.
But will we close the gate when the horse is bolted? Maybe the whole International Task Force Against Corruption's on the move, and they're doing, you know, that they've had this AML legislation, which has, you know, been smashing Australia on Chinese laundering of you know, drug money, God knows what money, in Australian realty for years and years and years and years. And that could be a trigger.
But that's interesting in that the whole, you know, will Australia tighten up on to stop Chinese, you know, pious civil servants on $30,000 a year coming over with their millions of dollars and investing in Australian property? China generally doesn't want them to.
No.
So they're...
Well, this is the irony of a lot of this, because a lot of our political economy was so corrupt around, you know, many, many dimensions of the relationship in the last 10 years at least, that a lot of the Chinese shift in Australian attitudes has actually been doing enormous favours to the Australian domestic populace, you know, because our own leadership was so corrupt. That they didn't do anything about it, and real estate's one example of that, definitely.
But it's almost there's the three sides we're trying to play. All of them we're trying to play the US side. So yes, we're close with the US, and we want to stay close with you. We're trying to play the Chinese government. Yeah, we want to be close with you and import and export as much as we can. But we also want to be close with all these people who are fleeing you with all this ill-gotten gains and investing in our houses.
Look, basically, to now it's been whoever offers me a dollar, I'll take it. That's it. You know, there really hasn't been much of a plan beyond that. I actually interviewed, the diplomat interviewed Peter Costello in 2006, 2005, when he was angling to roll John Howard.
Yeah.
And we asked him, you know, what's your long-term plan for China? And he said, oh, it's going to democratise and turn into a liberal economy. Yeah. Right, and that was it. There was nowhere else to go. And so that's been the prevailing attitude. Like, everything that has been happening is all part of reform as far as authorities were concerned.
She'll be right.
Then she'll be right.
Yeah.
You know, so it really has been a case of if you come to a fork in the road, take it. And keep splitting it, taking it.
Somebody offers you a dollar, take it.
Take it, that's right. So that's where we've been.
Do you think that, just finally, do you think there's a potential olive branch for sort of Australian-Chinese relations in perhaps helping to facilitate the information flow of people that are maybe... So you sort of think if you put yourself in China's shoes, you've got a big list of people that you think maybe have run away with a fair whack of, you know, ill-gotten gains.
Yeah.
Is there something for Australia to turn around and say, well, look, you know, any information you need, like, we're going to try and stop it on our side, but, you know, and therefore... removing Australia as a bit of a you know, happy valley that people can run off to because you've got something there.
Would that we've resisted that today. Like, yeah, we wouldn't do extradition.
No, well, that's I guess the next stage, isn't it?
To be honest, I don't think it'll ever be done now.
Mm.
And there was the Four Corners stuff this week about Chinese bounty hunters roaming the land, you know, trying to reclaim assets and people. Mm. You know,
through the legal system.
And sub-legal, you know. And, I mean, at the same time, Australian authorities have helped as well.
You'd like to think we're in with the whole rule of law thing.
But it's piecemeal is the point.
Like, and slow from the sound of things.
Piecemeal and slow. So, you know, Australia has been a pretty reasonable bolt hole for the Chinese. But I think that that's also in serious jeopardy, A, because I don't think the Chinese are going to let... Increasingly, they're not going to let money leave. But although Australian attitudes now have hardened towards China, and that may make it look like more of a safe haven for the Chinese, only if you don't want to go back to China. Like, previously, there was a sort of freedom to be both Australian and Chinese. Mm. As if the current trajectory of relations continues... You know, that's not going to happen. You'll be one or the other.
Choose a side.
Yeah, I think so. Well, more so than it's been. So the prospect of this being a safe haven is less attractive than it was in that sense.
Okay.
You know, you'd be limiting your options more than you used to.
Sure thing. All right. So
you can see that in Huang Shimao.
Yeah.
You know, in his exile. That's obviously a very prominent example, but it is an example of how that's shaping.
All right, so changing to the other side now, looking from the Chinese borders, changes in attitude globally?
Yeah, well, I guess we've kind of already intimated some of these things. I think the easiest starting point for a lot of these changes is simply the rise of Xi Jinping as a new Chinese emperor.
An enduring leader.
An enduring leader.
And sorry, just to put that in perspective for anyone who's not following it closely. You know, it used to be that China's leaders had fixed terms, and he managed to appoint himself as a lifetime leader. Mm. So
yeah,
yeah.
And you know, what followed was just a much more aggressive power projection policy all around the world through various mechanisms, the One Belt One Road and island grabs in South China Sea. And this sharp power, as it's called, which is what we've been describing, which is, you know, the United Front, they call it. It's a Chinese Communist Party kind of social club almost, where, you know, shadowy money tries to influence policy behind the border in various countries. You know, all of these things have been part of a much more aggressive outreach from China since the ascension of Xi Jinping to kind of permanent leadership status. So, you know, I see that as a bit of a turning point for those attitudes. The interesting thing now is, as we've described, you know, you've got a pretty reasonable catalogue of Australian pushback. And, you know, it's been happening worldwide, you know, largely under the aegis of the US trade war. But, you know, for instance, Europe isn't vociferously behind the Trump attack on Chinese trade cheating, but it's tacitly quite supportive.
Mm-hmm.
Places like Germany, for instance, you know,
and it's outright rejected sort of some of the advances that China made to.
Yes, to, China did try to charm its way out by isolating the US, and that didn't work at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know. This is a really interesting moment now for China, where it's kind of had this global pushback. You know, there's a lot of unpopularity kind of around the Trump administration, but the one thing just about everyone agrees on is, you know, he's called out China, you know, rightly on trade cheating. And so where does China go from here? And, you know, it basically, for the last 15 years, just laid low, right? And as Damo described before, worked its way into this fabulous position in the global economy and trading network, slowly built its power, not, you know, very much avoided treading on anyone's toes, especially the great power of the day.
Mm.
But, you know, it's getting this pushback now on all fronts, you know, even on One Belt, One Road, in areas of the world that are not especially US aligned.
Mm.
You know, a lot of the investment is being shoved back because it comes with strings attached that the local regimes are not keen on.
Mm.
So what does China do now? I mean, it appears to be bridling, which is getting more aggressive rather than, you know, perhaps, you know, taking a hit at this point, maybe doing a decent trade deal with the US, at least trying to get one done. That, you know, would kick the can, and it can just lay low for another 10 years and maybe generate a little bit more policy, you know, acquiescence in the West. You know, just keep things under wraps for longer while it gets, you know, bigger and more powerful. Rather than that, it seems to have gotten more aggressive and hostile. And, you know, one might even dare say irrational in its responses. So we're seeing things, you know, like the Canadian arrests following the Huawei arrests,
mm.
you know, which really look like
tit for tat,
reprisals. You know, there appears to be something going horribly wrong in New Zealand student intake numbers. That's preliminary, but it looks that way.
So when you say that, what do you mean?
The enrolments are diving.
Okay.
Basically, you know, can't say for certain at this point what that means, but mm-hmm. you know, it could be something along, you know, that New Zealand needs some external pressure. You know, we saw last week this extraordinary cyber attack on the Australian Parliament. Now, you can see the Australian government is trying to manage these conflicts by not pointing the finger at China, but under the radar, everybody knows who it was, and that's been published, you know, in various reliable sources in the press. and, you know, the Chinese media itself has become a very... it's always been a very loud mouthpiece of the CCP, but even more so.
Mm.
Every time there's a new issue, it's banging the drum. And so, you know, there's a bit of a pattern of behaviour here where China's having been pushed back from what was a sort of clandestine strategy has been forced into the open, and rather than perhaps, you know, just take a bit of pain and regroup, it's actually getting more aggressive instead.
Mm. Yeah. And that was that interesting theory I'd sort of speaking about before, where you know, suggesting some of the reason behind it was that they had you know, the leaders of China 10 years ago had grown up in poverty, and 10 or 15 years ago had all grown up in poverty and had seen the dramatic transformation and accumulated all these wealth. And there's a lot of people, though, who have been, a lot of the junior people who were then appointed had grown up in wealth and had never actually seen anything different, and had always had been to foreign universities with millions of dollars and, you know, multi-million dollar penthouse apartments and all that type of stuff. And so had grown up with a more of a sense of entitlement about what China's
rights
role
were.
And rights and things like that. And so the question is some of this being driven by that, which is just a bit of a generational change in terms of who you're dealing with, in terms of, you know, I don't want to lay low for 10 years.
Mm.
You know, I want things now. And, you know, we've paid good money for those politicians. I want to be allowed in to do what I paid them originally to do.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it could be hubris. I mean...
That doesn't seem rational, though, as you said. It doesn't seem like a rational response.
No, it's not what I would do if I were carefully planning my world domination. No, I'd lick my wounds and I'd...
Yeah. Come back in 10 years' time.
Yeah, I would. I mean, quietly just go back to doing what we were doing, you know, stealing... tech and, you know, et cetera. Obviously, you know, some of the calling out of China is going to make that more difficult, but I still think they could have done it a good enough deal with the US to stay under the radar a little longer. Yep. But anyway, they don't appear to be doing that, at least not for the time being. So this is where we start to begin to tip into potential implications, direct implications for Australia. And one thing I haven't mentioned yet as part of this pattern of more aggressive behaviour is Australian coal, which in December suddenly got on the nose in China and started queuing up at ports and undergoing, you know, mysteriously long customs approval processes and what have you. Now, it was also initially broader, this coal slowdown from China, like just importing less. But over the sort of 3 to 4 months since, it's just gotten progressively more targeted at Australia to such a point now where Australian coal is just being explicitly and in particular being held up at Chinese ports, and it's both thermal and coking coal. So we've got this chart here, which from Credit Suisse, which showed this is up to the end of Q4 last year, the end of December, and the red line shows you the export volumes of iron ore and coal.
And for anyone who can't see, it sort of hung around at sort of above zero for a while, and then pretty sharply at the end of 2018, it's dropped to sort of -40%.
Yes,
and sort of back to just -20% now.
That's right, and the thermal, that was all thermal coal in Q4, and then it started to rebound, but suddenly now in the last month and in particular the last few weeks, it's shifted to coking coal instead, and now thermal coal's in the doghouse again as well. So while these are not particularly harmful real impacts for Australia, they would be if they were permanent, but given they're more likely to be temporary messages
in
economic form, they do potentially have in them some damage in that volumes is the input into GDP via net exports, not prices. Now, we know prices have been going crazy after Vale, and it's a terrible accident for iron ore and coking coal, but more important for GDP is volumes. Volumes are the actual calculation that tips into GDP. So net exports for Q4 would have been booming on the back of LNG and some other stuff. Had this not happened. Instead, they'll be basically zero. And it sets Australian Q4 GDP up for a big miss. And that comes out next month, I think, the day after the RBA meeting. And, you know, it's odds on that we're going to get quite a nasty number. And so it's going to blow up everybody's forecasts. It'll damage sentiment, which we know is already kind of breaking and brittle with the housing market, you know, tumbling. And what's more, it's shifted now to Q1 of this year. And so this could actually play a role. This will almost certainly play a role, in my view, in putting Australia in a per capita recession. We're already in per capita recession in the September quarter. I think it's quite likely we'll be in per capita recession in December. So, you know, again, that goes to sentiment and, you know, won't help the consumer. And then it's quite possible that, you know, that will be sustained also into Q1, all on the back of this coal's fiddling by China. So the real impacts are not really the coal in that example. Okay, so that's one thing where we're getting some signalling, as you put it nicely. The next one, and this is maybe just pop over to the next chart and we'll show a real impact. This is the boom and bust in Chinese capital flows into real estate via FIRB numbers. You could probably times this by about 100 to get the real numbers.
Yep.
You know, because, I mean, the NAB survey at the time, I think, was showing at the peak of the Chinese capital inflow that the Chinese were transacting almost 1 in 5 Australian housing
purchases. Wow.
And so, that's for anyone just listening in on the podcast, that's just sort of showing a very steep decline, sort of 100% growth.
Yeah, just massive boom and massive bust.
2 or 3 years ago, back to...
There's also the charts will be available in a link in the podcast notes.
Now, this outflow of capital is clearly playing a role in making Australian house price correction worse, like much worse.
Mm.
You might even argue that this is what the major driver. You know, this is going to continue, and this is going to do real economic harm. To be perfectly honest, we have it coming.
Mm.
We should never have let it in the first place. So it's a bit pointless kind of bewailing its exit. It's a good thing over the long run that it goes. But nonetheless, it's going to do real damage to the economy, obviously, through the usual channels and multipliers of falling house prices.
Yep.
Okay, so that's another signal that we're getting. And then if we pop back to the former chart, which is Chinese visitors, tourists and students. This is the big one for the future. And as you can see, for the last nearly 12 months, the trade has plateaued. The number of Chinese coming in as tourists and foreign students hasn't grown over the last 12 months. And this is a very easy lever. If the Chinese want to get a little bit more nasty and put a bit more pressure on, they can flick this easy. They just tweak their visas, and their visa system, and suddenly this trade collapses. I don't know if that's coming, but it's the next obvious risk for the Australian economy. And you could argue, given the growth trajectory before that, that something along those lines is already happening in the tapering, you know, in the plateauing of the numbers. That said, it could be related simply to Chinese economic weakness, which is obviously at the moment deepening.
So this is a tourism or education or both?
This is both
yep.
together. Okay. And, you know, what we're seeing in New Zealand may be the leading edge of political pressure to come here. So, you know, this one is in particular related as well to the capital inflows into real estate, because the student trade in particular is associated directly with apartment purchases and therefore dwelling construction, etc. So this potentially could make the real estate bust also worse, but more generally than that, if the trade doesn't resume growing, everyone has ongoing growth in this thing till 2050, 2100. If it just flattens out, it's another blow to the Australian economy. There's a lot of education investment underway that will taper off, but this one's on a sort of watching brief as the next big risk if this relationship continues to deteriorate.
Okay.
So we want to move forward to...
We'll jump through looking forward in the interest of time.
Yeah, so... I guess recapping, I think Australia has been more or less forced to make a Cold War II choice, Cold War 2.0 choice. We're fighting against it, but it's proving very difficult, and China becoming more hostile is only going to make that harder. I think the more they push, the more we'll be forced to push back rather than acquiesce. You know, we still think we're probably going to get some kind of US trade deal between China and the US, and that's obviously holds out the hope that relations between the US alliance network and China will improve in the short term. However, we don't think we'll get a substantive deal. If we do get one, it'll be largely based around helping improve the bilateral trade deficit and, you know, some kind of can kick on the tech stuff. Not sure, you know, but don't think it'll be it will resolve the great power tensions.
Might be a dam buster.
We suspect probably more designed around stopping future escalation rather than trying to roll back existing issues and things like that.
And you know, I think we touched on this with one of our China ones, where China can wait out Trump, but we can't, you know, Trump can't, or US can't wait out Xi Jinping.
if your choice is waiting out Trump to get somebody who's just as, regardless of which other party, they're just as hardened against
Bernie Sanders,
and actually quite possibly more likely to negotiate with a future in mind rather than, like, a longer term future in mind rather than the next sort of tweet, you know, the next sort of claim of a win, then, you know, I would argue you're better off trying to get a deal with Trump that you can probably entice him with a here's this great big short term gain for a long term loss, whereas I don't think that's possible with a lot of other more long-term minded.
Astute.
Yeah.
Fair enough. All right. Yep.
So that kind of deal would actually itself be quite bad for Australia, because it would represent a lot of trade diversion that would directly attack Australian exports to China, in particular coal and gas, oil and gas. Even if we get that deal, it's potentially intrinsically poor for Australian economic outcomes.
So when you say that, you mean the potential for the US to step on the fingers of Australia to prepare?
A trade into China that Australia currently enjoys goes to the US.
Yeah, I mean, we were arguing that probably not. That's across the board. It's probably not as likely, but there are particular sectors, and gas is the one big sector and oil as well. We were arguing for, you know, pretty much since the start of Trump, is that, you know, if Trump's complaining about China, that the easiest thing China can do is just start saying, well, we'll stop buying oil from the Middle East and we'll start buying it from the US, and that just means that the whole world will shift around where they use oil, but they get to fix, China gets to fix its bilateral US without changing its, you know, its actual trade balances, really. Besides just shifting things around, it would have been a relatively quick and easy win. And it's still there as one of the potential things that could happen, which just basically means Australian oil and gas will probably just have to go somewhere else and travel further to get to wherever it's going.
Now the latest news on the deal is that China will commit, in inverted commas, to a stable yuan as well. Now, that may sound good, but it's not for Australia. This is where we get into, obscure macroeconomics and the impossible trinity of controlling interest rates, capital flows, and your currency all at once. It's impossible to do. So if they're going to commit to a stable yuan with the US, it means they're going to have to shut down capital flows because they're also got a domestic slowdown underway, and they are going to have to continue to ease monetary policy, cut interest rates on the back of that. That would normally sink your currency. You know, capital will flow out. They're going to have to block that. And so this is where you come around again back to Chinese capital leaving Australian real estate. If the Chinese are going to commit to that stable yuan, then Australian real estate is in... There's no resumption of that Chinese trade flow. And in fact, a lot of it... More recently, there was news that a lot of that stuff may even be forced repatriated. There may well be Chinese forced sales in Australian realty. The penalties have been ramped up significantly for cheating Chinese capital control laws. You know, you're now at like 5 years in jail and, you know, organs harvested, etc. It's another element of any deal.
David's saying that organs harvested with tongue in cheek. just to clarify.
Yes.
As opposed to tongue out of cheek.
The five years jail is real though.
Yes.
Not fun jail either.
No. Well, yeah. So another possible outcome here, or something that will be influenced by, you know, the short-term US trade deal, is, you know, what degree and where does China stimulate? They're less likely to stimulate with the deal and more likely to stimulate without it. And then you can sort of extrapolate from that the where various winners and losers. Without a deal, obviously, they'll probably try and build some more, but is that good for Australia? I mean, maybe for a year. But at the same time, you know, after that, how long can they continue to do this crazy building? I know we've been talking about that for a long time, but it certainly looks like they're running into trouble on that strategy. Further reprisals, again, if we go back to possibly the education and tourism trade, like if again, they've got to hold the yuan stable, but while trying to stimulate domestically, it could be the capital controls are not strong enough, and they actually have to shift those controls into the trade account. And they have to stop people, tourists and students, leaving the country to keep the money in the country. And so it does potentially represent a very nasty blow ongoing for Australia. And all of that is just macroeconomic. That's not even geopolitical. You know, like, obviously in the doing the deal on the yuan is geopolitical, but the consequences of that are simply macroeconomic. They're dominoes that simply flow in macroeconomic order. So yes, I mean, I guess swing to that next chart and we can run through it. I mean, it's bad for Australian realty. It's bad for Australian oil and gas. It's bad for the student tourism trade. Could be short-term good for bulk commodities, but eventually it's bad with too much, you know, Chinese debt, and it's pretty much all bad. I mean, I don't want to overdo it, but you know, this step change in both U.S.-Chinese relationship and, as a subset of that, the Australian-Chinese relationship does not hold out good prospects for the current Australian economic model. Now, if you have a long view on these things, as we do, you probably wouldn't see it as a bad thing to actually reform that structure. Anyway, we always argued we should never have gotten into it in the first place.
And so when David's talking about the structure, what we're talking about here is that, you know, with the rise of China, Australia has restructured its economy to be a supplier of either resources, of education and tourism, and we've basically let most of the other industries all die away, whether it's through you know, high gas prices or high Australian dollar, sort of forcing out manufacturers and services, and sort of so we've sort of attached ourselves to the Chinese
growth model
without the wider term view that's saying, well, if something like this happens and you get a falling out between and we need to pick a side and the side isn't China, then you have to restructure your economy back to something else the rest of the world wants.
Yeah. And so, you know, to do that, you need to fix, primarily you need to fix your real exchange rate to so you can compete again in things other than what Damien just mentioned, you know, non-resource exports. Tourism could still be a very... Tourism and education would still be, you know, be able to grow even without China. Like you'd have a Chinese adjustment, but you know those sectors can obviously operate in a much broader context than just the Chinese trade. But they've been allowed to kind of gear towards China in a big way. But you know you need to fix your real exchange rate, which means you know interest rates are going to go to zero. Your currency's got to fall a lot. You're going to go through a long period of low wage growth, low inflation, and eventually you come out the other side more diversified and less dependent on China. And I think that the framework that enabled us to do our you know, one-trick pony economic model,
our path of least resistance,
is more or less ending.
So
that's the path that we were going to end up having to take. And it doesn't come overnight, of course, and you get various adjustments along the way. You get one in housing now, you get you know, one later in interest rates or earlier, whatever, or a currency, whatever it happens to be. But you know, as the various components of that model unravel, then you know the other variables in your macroeconomic makeup just compensate, and you go through various adjustments until you come out the other side. You know, the truth is we're still, you know, quite well placed long term in Asia, I don't fear for us long term in terms of economic prosperity. We just did a one-eyed bet, and it's worked really well, but I think, you know, it's now, you know, we're going to pay a bit of a price for
time
it.
Time to pay the piper. Okay. Yeah. And just quickly, and finishing up, whilst we're on the topic of investment implications, both David and Damien, but practically, I guess for those listening at home, how are we positioning portfolios with Nucleus Wealth, given obviously the outlooks here?
Yeah, so the big thing, I'd like to focus is on the diversification side, is saying there's a lot of Australians, and I've got an article David's about to post on this very shortly, but there's a lot of Australians whose assets basically consist of some Australian shares, which mm-hmm. are based and in the Australian market. You know, we've got the banks and you've got all the real estate developers and property trusts and all these people all in the housing market. And so they're sort of all exposed in that. If you've got any fixed income, it often seems to be hybrids and stuff like that, which is often bank related as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a couple, odds are that one of those people work in some sort of property related business, whether it be finance or development or
mortgage broking
or real estate services. Mm. You go through the whole raft. So when people look at their portfolios, they should be saying, okay, they might disbelieve everything we've said and said, no, I think Australia's going to sail through, something's going to show up and I'll be fine. But the issue is, if you're fine and all you've got is assets that are leveraged to that, then don't worry about it too much. If your job's dependent upon that and all these other things, what you want to worry about is a case where it's not fine and that case you do start to go into these types of issues where you need assets. Like the key ones for us is government bonds, mm-hmm. Foreign cash, depending upon which currency. We've generally US dollar, but there are other ones that sort of give you benefits there. So international shares to a certain extent, but government bonds is the safest part.
Yep.
A little bit more risk in terms of taking foreign cash because you do have a currency risk, but we think the odds are we need a lower dollar to get the adjustment. And then international shares, depending upon the valuations and where you're getting and things like that, we're a lot more excited about international shares last year, early last year, and we think that we've been winding back. We still think there are good reasons to have exposure,
mm-hmm.
but we've certainly been winding back in terms of our exposure there.
Okay, all right, fantastic. But
getting diversification.
Yep.
Keep it for people now.
All right, thanks for that, Damien, and thanks very much, gentlemen, for coming in and sharing with us some thoughts on Australia and China and where we think the economy is headed. So we'll jump across into next week. So for next week, same bat time, same bat channel, Thursday the 28th of February, we are looking at franking credits and you. So we're going to have a little run through on our take on some of these proposed changes to the franking credit, or the way it stands now and what it may look like under a proposed Labor government. I've got a couple of interesting insights to do with some of the investment side of franking credits and how they relate to overseas versus local investments as well, and some bits and pieces on superannuation. So if you're interested in franking credits at all, feel free to check that one out and head over to our Nucleus Wealth live webinar page to see that one. Look forward to putting that one together for you next week. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe, give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.